Bridger Productions has produced the Audible audiobook of Texas-based singer-songwriter, historian, playwright Bobby Bridger's award-winning book, Buffalo Bill and Sitting Bull, Inventing the Wild West. Published in print in 2002 by the University of Texas Press, Buffalo Bill and Sitting Bull, Inventing the Wild West was awarded Forward Magazine's Gold Award as the best biography of 2002. I'm Grady Kirkpatrick. Very happy to welcome back to Wyoming Public Radio, Bobby Bridger. How are you?
I'm great. It's great to hear your voice again, Grady.
This audiobook follows the 2018 release of The World We Used to Live In, Remembering the Powers of the Medicine Men by Vine Deloria Jr., narrated by actor Wes Studi, that you worked on. When did the idea for doing an audiobook for Buffalo Bill and Sitting Bull arise?
Well, I actually had it back in 2002 when had that idea in 2002 when I published the book with the University of Texas Press, because I held the audiobook rights out of the deal for myself, and so something in me knew I wanted to do an audiobook eventually of it.
Well, audiobooks have really gained in popularity over the past several years. What are the advantages of audiobooks?
Well, they're definitely convenient. For one thing, I don't have to have a massive inventory here in my office anymore. It's much more convenient for the listener as well. They can just carry their phone with them wherever they're going and plug in a pair of headphones, and if they're running, walking, doing whatever, they can listen to a book.
Yeah, a lot of folks use it when traveling cross-country, too,
listening to books. Yeah, particularly. That's where they first really gained popularity back years ago.
I'd like to ask if you could read a passage from Buffalo Bill, Sitting Bull, and Inventing the Wild West.
Of course. Yeah, I'd be delighted to do that. I'm particularly fond of the opening to the prologue. It was written by Frank Waters, as a matter of fact, who was a dear old friend of mine. Quote, "As a child, one has a dream about life. As one grows up and out into life, one tries to make the dream come true," she once said. All of this endeavor to live that life of the dreaming child. What do we know of this strange and wonderful journey, from what to where? Whatever her dream and journey, if she ever knew it, it may have begun with the yellow Indian. She saw him when she was taken by her nursemaid to Buffalo Bill's Wild West show at the Crystal Palace. Trembling with excitement, she watched the doors of the arena open. Out rumbled the stagecoach behind its galloping horses. Then came the pursuing Indians, whooping and yelling, firing their guns, feathers and their war bonnets streaming as they raced around the arena. One of them, bareback on a pinto horse, rode at first sight into her undying memory. 70, 80 years later, she could still vividly recall his naked, slim young body painted bright lemon yellow, a creature of the wild. Of limitless space and untrammeled freedom, he flashed everywhere like a lightning streak of lemon yellow before her, like an archetypal image emerging from her dark unconsciousness to consolate the dream image she was to pursue for a lifetime. I'll add here that that lady, Dorothy Brett, was of royalty herself. Later that spring afternoon was magnetically charged with historic occurrence, and the lemon-yellow Lakota warrior struck like lightning, imprinting 5-year-old Dorothy Brett as Buffalo Bill and his Sioux companions, this is my reading here, rolled past like thunderheads that gather to bring terrifying yet fascinating electrical shocks from the heavens. Cody had choreographed his Wild West to begin with racing horsemen proudly circling the arena, presenting the Star-Spangled Banner in a grand entry, a tradition that continues in rodeo today. Cody's colorful commencement of his Wild West made history on that afternoon of May 11, 1887, as Cody's cowboys raced past Her Majesty presenting Old Glory, the supreme sovereign of the British Empire stood and with a simple, elegant bow saluted the American flag for the first time in history. I can never read that section without getting chill bumps.
Bobby Bridger reading from his award-winning book, Buffalo Bill and Sitting Bull, Inventing the Wild West, now out in audiobook form. Most Americans, especially Westerners, are familiar with at least the names, Buffalo Bill and Sitting Bull. And it seems to me there are three parts to this story, and they're all intertwined. The life of Will Cody, Sitting Bull, both were part of the Plains Indian Wars and westward expansion, and then the Wild West shows of the late 19th and early 20th century. The book contains key events and people of that time that were part of their lives. Can you name some of the other key historical people that are included in the stories, both Euro-American and Native American?
One in particular is Cody's crossing paths with the notorious Jack Slade early on when he was a Pony Express rider, when Cody was riding for the Pony Express. Slade would kill a man within the blink of an eye, and everyone walked in fear when Slade was anywhere nearby. And yet he took a shine to young Cody and hired him often to ride for the Pony Express when other people were sick or whatever, and called him in for work. I think that crossing of paths in some way informed most of the villains of the cowboy movies of the 40s and 50s. They usually had the name Slade or something that was similar to that, and they fit Jack Slade's description to the T with a kind of a pencil-thin mustache, almost the oil can Harry villain of early movies and so forth. Another character I think that's very important to talk about with Buffalo Bill is actually Wild Bill Hickok. There's a lot of controversy among the revisionist historians about whether Cody actually rode for the Pony Express, and if not, how did he and Wild Bill get to be pals and so forth? But I'm of the school that believes that I went through all of the different shadings and all of the different biographies and so forth, and came back to Cody's own autobiography, and I decided to take him for his word with what he said. And that following that rule, I assume he did ride for the Pony Express and he did work for the Russell Majors and Waddell shipping firm when he was a pre-adolescent kid. And so with that in mind, that's where he met Wild Bill Hickok, who was 8 years older than Buffalo Bill, Cody, and according to Wild Bill, kind of took him under his wing as a guardian angel when he was a mere pup and out on the prairie with some of the most rambunctious, let's say, plainsmen that ever existed, the bullwhackers. And so, assuming all that's true, there's a famous story about a bullwhacker picking on young Bill Cody, and Wild Bill stepping in on his behalf after Cody threw a hot pitcher of coffee in the guy's face to keep him from hurting him. And bear in mind, Cody was barely 11 years old, and this guy was a full-grown man, and Wild Bill stepped in to protect him, according to Buffalo Bill, and from that day forth, looked out after him at every turn.
One of the events in Will Cody's life that appeared to have a great impact was when the family moved to a farm near Leavenworth, Kansas in 1854. Will was 9 years old. His father, Isaac, was thought to be pro-slavery and was urged to make a speech at a political rally in town. He stepped up to the soapbox and plainly stated he was morally opposed to slavery. The mob went silent. A man jumped from the crowd and stabbed Isaac twice in the back. It didn't kill him, but he never fully recovered and eventually died within a few years. How did that event affect the young Will Cody?
He was orphaned very quickly. His mother died soon after Isaac, his father, died. But that happened when he was 9 years old. And he often said later as an adult that he thought his father perhaps shed the first blood of the Civil War there in Bloody Kansas as the Civil War essentially broke out there between abolitionists who wanted Kansas to enter the state with the Kansas-Nebraska Act as a free state, and pro-slavery forces, which were basically coming out of Missouri, that wished for Kansas to enter as a slave state. And how did it affect Cody? He was the person who had to drag his father, who was bleeding nearly to death, across the river to Missouri, to his Uncle Elijah's sanctuary, in order for him to survive the attack at all. And as you mentioned, he only lived a couple of more years, and he became a devout abolitionist at that point, Isaac Cody did. So I think the whole event had a profound effect on young Will. And shortly thereafter, his mother died. But before Mary Cody died, she had already arranged for him to go to work for the largest commercial venture west of the Mississippi River, there in Leavenworth, Russell, Majors, and Waddell Shipping, which shipped goods out to all of the fringe little communities on the frontier in these massive J. Murphy wagons, which would be like the 18-wheelers of today, carrying goods and groceries to our stores. They would carry in 30 wagon caravans, actually 60 wagon caravans. They would travel two caravans at once for safety from Indians. And they hired these little messenger boys to go back and forth. They didn't have any kind of communication, so they would take six young orphan boys on mules riding constantly from the front of the two wagon trains, the 60 wagons, to the others with messages so they knew what was going on amongst each other while they were en route. So Cody went to work when he was 11 doing that kind of work.
And that's when he first ventured out onto the plains and headed west?
Yes.
Yeah. Some of his earliest childhood friends were actually Native American kids, is that correct?
Yes. In those days, Red Cloud, the famous war chief of the Oglala Lakota band, had moved from their traditional residence in the Black Hills to Fort Laramie. And they were so large a group that many of them became known as the Hangs Around the Fort group, because there was a virtual community of Indians living around Fort Laramie at that time. And that was pretty much the end goal with the Murphy wagon caravans across the plains from Leavenworth. They would end their route there in Fort Laramie, and it would go head back to Leavenworth. And so after a sojourn there, that's where he met most of those young Lakota boys, and they dubbed him Pahaska because he wore his hair long like they did. Yeah. And that meant long hair in Lakota.
What were some of the key elements in Sitting Bull's ascension to become the great leader he was for the Lakotas?
Well, he started out slow, you might say. His birth name was Slow. His parents called him Slow because he was so ponderous. He would take, with his food, he would even hold it in his hand and take a long time looking at it before he would eat it and studying the food. And so that he was very ponderous, let's say, as a young infant. So they called him Slow. But when it came to battle, he was anything but. Soon after that war party moved forward with young Slow with his coup stick and his father, they indeed saw a Crow war party and decided to ambush them, set the ambush, and were on a ridge waiting to surprise and spring on the Crow war party when young Slow broke the silence by running down the hill screaming war cries and attacking the Crow war party by himself, hitting them all on the leg with his coup stick. And the Crows were stunned, had no idea that he was even real. They thought he might be a spirit, a young 14-year-old boy attacking them out on the prairie. And soon the Lakota party joined them in the fight, and the Crows were wiped out. And from that day forward, however, Sitting Bull was known as a great warrior, 14 years old forward.
I'm Grady Kirkpatrick, talking with Bobby Bridger about the audio version of the book, Buffalo Bill and Sitting Bull Inventing the Wild West. Bobby, what motivated you to do this book?
Well, as you know, I had written an epic ballad about Jim Bridger, my relative, who's having his birthday today. We mentioned it at the start of the show. And I felt like I needed a companion piece to avoid being just writing another thing about mountain men or something about the winning of the West or something like that. And I went straight into writing a piece about the Plains Indian Wars called Lakota. And I knew then, after I finished that piece, that there needed to be a piece in between that would balance them. And I decided to go after, and when I say after, I mean not in a good way, William F. Cody. And I wrote a piece in the early 70s, which basically was an allegory with him standing in for John Wayne and the Vietnam War and being the big celebrity during the Indian Wars and all that. And thank God I was told in advance that there was already a play called Indians that Arthur Copit, the great playwright, had written that was later turned into a movie called Buffalo Bill and the Indians, or Sitting Bull's Great History Lesson by Robert Altman, and which wasn't a very good movie, but it set me in a tailspin for several years. I wrote many other drafts and destroyed them all. And in the early 90s, my dear best friend of 30 years, Vine Deloria, let me know. He had published an essay in the early 70s with the permission of the, actually commissioned by the Buffalo Bill Historical Center, given carte blanche to write what he wanted about Buffalo Bill. And he gave him a very favorable review in an essay called The Indians. Well, I promptly read that, and my feelings about Buffalo Bill changed instantly to one of great favor instead of disdain. And I started taking Vine's lead to dig deeper into his mythology. And Vine gave me the most important clue that I had for what became this book, because I very quickly got entangled in the revisionist versions of Cody, which said he did not ride with the Pony Express, that he did not work for the bullwhacker trains, that basically that most of the Buffalo Bill mythology was a fabrication of press agents and so forth and so forth. between that and what Cody said about himself in his autobiography and what Don Russell said in what I consider to be the definitive biography of Buffalo Bill. And Vine, I went back to Vine, and Vine said, here's what you have to do, Bobby. He said, you have to look for what isn't written. And that took me on the journey that became this book and continues to this day. For example, they say he didn't learn about, he didn't work for the Bullwacker trains, when it's a documented fact that with several very well-respected military generals, when they were majors and captains in the military, when Cody would do feats of wonder, logistical feats of wonder with supply trains, often caught out on such things as a mesa that they would have to descend, and Cody would put together a makeshift bull and tackle rigging to let wagons descend down steep inclines and so forth. How did he learn to drive a coach through the narrow streets of London to promote his shows in the Wild West if he didn't learn how to drive a team of horses with the Deadwood stage when he was, you know, a kid? Those things begin to make sense when you read back in an autobiography then and seeing that he had to learn skills as these jobs that they claimed he didn't do, which I still claim that he did do. So I grew to hold him in great respect and admiration, and still do. And that's why I wrote the book, to show what his contributions were, and particularly the contributions that he facilitated for Indians to give to the American people.
Although he was in the Army and fought in the Plains Indian Wars, Buffalo Bill had great respect for Native Americans throughout his life. What do you think Will Cody and Sitting Bull would think about the United States and the West in the 21st century?
Well, that's interesting you asked that question, because I wrote a book that came out in 2011 under the title of Where the Tall Grass Grows, Becoming Indigenous and the Mythological Legacy of the American West, was the subtitle. The inspiration for that book was, I was a part of a symposium panel in 2006 that the Western Writers of America hosted at the Buffalo Bill Center in Cody, Wyoming. I was on a panel with 10 other authors. All of us had published books since 1996 that were largely favorable accounts of Buffalo Bill. And that puzzled me a great deal until it dawned on me that the link between all 10 of us was that we had read Vine Deloria's essay, The Indians, that I mentioned earlier. Also, the other thing that occurred to me was this was after 9/11. And our country was searching for mythological heroes to help inspire us after we'd been attacked by terrorists. And we came up short because most of us realized that we had been living in the era of the anti-hero since the 1950s, 1940s and 50s, post-World War II. And that inspired me to think, well, what is this link between John Wayne now, who is this representative of the American patriot, so to speak, and Bill Cody back in the 19th century? I thought, I'm going to have to write a book about that, and that's what this second book became. And I think in that book, I pretty much answered your question. You know, we now have an indigenous Secretary of Interior, which is an incredible, a phenomenal achievement, if you just pause for a moment and think about what that really means. Sitting Bull said, the white man knows how to make wonderful things. The problem is he doesn't know how to properly distribute them. And I think that maybe says something about what's the state we're in right now. We're having to learn how to properly distribute our wealth and our wonderful technology. And I think if we could distribute what we know, they might be a little more pleased with our position now. But I think Cody would be quite at home with a lot of the publicity that the movies do right now, and the show business aspect of things. I don't think he would be happy with the way Indians and other minorities have been depicted in art. I think he made a great deal of his career based on properly depicting Indian people in the Wild West.
They once numbered in the millions, then the buffalo or bison were nearly exterminated. Buffalo numbers then and now are quite different. In the book, there's an itemized description of the number and location of the remaining buffalo from the late 1800s. I read a recent article that stated 400,000 Plains bison are in North America, so it has been quite a turnaround.
Well, it always sticks in my craw when I hear people say that Buffalo Bill destroyed the buffalo and killed all of the bison and destroyed the American West. That was one of his reasons for starting the Wild West in the first place. That was his inspiration. It sickened him to think, while he was alive, that Americans and the world considered him to be the man who single-handedly destroyed the bison. If you want to pin the tail on that donkey, you need to pin it on Philip Sheridan, I would say, him and General Sherman. They were the first to introduce environmental warfare to the Great Plains Wars in the 1860s and through the 1890s. They were the ones that said, kill the Indian's commissary and you'll kill the Indian. By the time Cody was a scout for the 5th Cavalry and no longer killing bison, I've read another statistic that said you could have put 50 Buffalo Bills killing the number that he killed in his peak, killing and slaughtering as well as all the Indians and all the hide hunters, and they still wouldn't have knocked a dent in the number of buffalo that were there in the 1860s by the time Cody had already stopped, 1868, by the time Cody had already stopped hunting buffalo for the railroad. So that's a big misunderstanding of the mythology right there, mm-hmm. One that I like to try to correct very quickly. And as a matter of fact, the reason those bison were able to be documented, and I could put it in my book, is because of a man named Buffalo Jones who had the courage to take a young buffalo calf from its mother and start a reseeding operation that eventually brought him to take, at the lowest point, when there were less than 100 left in the world, over 20 of those animals were in the Wild West show. The rest there were taken from zoos and so forth to replenish the herd. But Buffalo Jones was the reason you could actually document them, and Cody was doing a great job of keeping the rest of them healthy.
I've been talking with Bobby Bridger about Buffalo Bill and Sitting Bull, Inventing the Wild West, now in audiobook form. Bobby, where can people find the audiobook?
This book is exclusively on Audible. I decided to do it exclusively with them for just one of the reasons that you were asking about earlier, convenience. I have had my offices full of everything from the old 45 RPM singles to CDs and 8-track tape machines and so forth over the years, and they just end up, as the technology advances and things, formats change, you end up, what do I do with these things? And I love the streaming format, and so I decided to go exclusively with Audible this time. They are the leading distributor of audiobooks on the globe, and I thought, why not start there?
Bobby Bridger, it's been a great pleasure. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Nothing except to thank you and Wyoming Public Media for so graciously and kindly letting me have occasionally a voice on Wyoming Public Radio, either through my music or one of these audiobooks. As you know, I've spent a great deal of my 60-year career performing there in Wyoming, and I have a lot of dear, dear friends there and love my time there, and I get all choked up even thinking about it, but thank you and everyone there at Wyoming Public Media for giving me that opportunity. I really appreciate it.